It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Let's cook dinner together. Just you and me. We've bought only the best food. Organic, pesticide-free, no preservatives, no additives. Now imagine doing all of this, but in the 19th century.
It's like a carnival of adulteration. There's no government standards for anything.
This is science writer Deborah Blum.
There was an insane amount of food fraud in the late 19th century. We had just opened up this candy box of new industrial chemicals, formaldehyde, sodium benzoate, borax.
Borax is the stuff that I use to scrub out my sink or to, you know, put on the counter to keep the ants away. You're saying people put that in food intentionally?
Yes.
There was no food safety, no regulation. Really, it's kind of amazing anyone survived.
I actually kind of love the borax story because they discovered these huge mining opportunities with borax out in California. And they discovered that it also had some antiseptic qualities, right? It was antimicrobial. And it doesn't taste that bad, which is one of the things that's really important. They put it in butter going to England. You actually had them say, the British love the taste of borax in their butter, right? It was a fury. This is a wonderful thing, and everything tastes better with borax. Because they were using borax and then, of course, formaldehyde, which is an embalming fluid, they started calling these preserved products embalmed beef, embalmed milk. One of the manufacturers, when he was talking about the use of borax in meat, would say, "We all eat embalmed beef, and we love it."
Embalmed beef. What a horrible thing to say about what you're eating.
Coffee. Coffee was simply a mix of a little coffee and a lot of fake, and people would char bones and crumble them in. They would dye sawdust, often with lead-based blacking compounds, and mix that in. And so people would actually speculate that the whole origin of the phrase "a muddy cup of coffee" came from the fact that you were drinking mud.
Ew. So complain all you want about overzealous government regulators, but without them, we would still be drinking dirt. Deborah Blum shares all the gory details with Steve Paulson. And Steve, who is not a picky eater, had one question. Did embalming food work?
Formaldehyde is a good preservative. It stops bodies from rotting. And in milk, it worked really well. Take this with a grain of salt, because I do not drink formaldehyde. But the story is that it's kind of slightly sweetish in taste. So you see this conversation in the 19th century about how it restores the taste of bad milk, right? Thanks to the wonders of formaldehyde, it has that fresh, sweet taste again. So in the case of dairy products, they loved formaldehyde.
So was it actually dangerous to put these substances, like formaldehyde and borax, in these foods?
People got sick or they died, and especially children. You're feeding what turned out to be higher and higher doses of formaldehyde to young children in their milk. They died. There was a case in Indianapolis, and they clocked more than 400 deaths.
Wow. So let's talk about the man at the center of your story, this chemistry professor named Harvey Washington Wiley, who was brought into the government to start testing some of these foods. Who was this guy?
So he was a Midwesterner, got an MD in Indiana. He got a chemistry degree at Harvard, and he had actually gone to Europe where they were much more advanced about this stuff. He was recruited by the federal government to be the chief chemist in agriculture's tiny bureau of chemistry. It had six chemists, and it was in a basement.
And then there was another thing he did. He actually got some of his people to taste some of these foods.
Yes.
To see if they would get sick.
This experiment started in 1902, and there's none of all the IRB and human subject
right.
protection rules that we have now. He's just like, yo, I'm going to ask for volunteers in the federal government to dine dangerously. And that's what he did. He set up this experiment that was nicknamed the Poison Squad by the local newspapers, in which he got young male government employees, clerks who had very little money and were happy to get free meals. And that was the sort of deal with the devil. We'll give you three free meals a day, beautifully cooked by our master chef and only using great ingredients. But half of you, for given periods of time, are going to have to also take capsules of the suspect compound of that particular test. So you'll be having borax with every meal, or you'll be having formaldehyde with every meal.
With a poison dinner party, you know, this group of young men to see how sick they're going to get.
It is really like that. You know, it's interesting because one of the things the Washington Post just loved the story and they saw endless opportunities for entertaining their readers with it. They actually created like a fake holiday menu. It's like turkey, a little borax, butter, rolls, a little borax. But basically what happened was they created a kitchen and a dining room in the basement of the agriculture department. They've got white tablecloths and ladder-back chairs. And the deal was that they had to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner in this dining room, and they were not allowed to eat anything anywhere else. No go out for a beer with friends. No sneak a snack. I'm not sure you would be able to persuade anyone today to do that.
Right. Yeah. So how sick did they get?
Some of them got really sick, and it really depended on the compound. With formaldehyde, people were really throwing up. So sick, so fast that they just canceled the test. With borax, it was more gradual. They took very low doses, and then they would ratchet the dose up. And what they found was at very low doses, you know, some of them were a little whiny, but no one was really sick. By the time you started hitting a medium dose, people had stomach upsets, they had GI upsets, they had headaches, they had bloating. Eating this cleanser on a daily basis was not working for them.
So he came up with all of these results. I mean, this really kind of remarkable science experiment to testing all these different foods. How did the food industry respond?
The food industry was really unhappy, really unhappy. The Pacific Borax Company, this will be a term we use today, fake news. They had their publicists assume a fake name and plant fake stories in newspapers across the country, criticizing Wiley and pretending that people were dying of food poisoning because borax was not around. I mean, you know, it was really crazy.
Wow. Now, there are some other sort of fascinating characters in the story that you tell. One is the writer Upton Sinclair, whose 1906 novel, The Jungle, was all about the appalling conditions in the stockyards of Chicago. And you know, he wanted to expose sort of how horrible the working conditions were in these slaughterhouses. But it sort of had other unintended effects, didn't it?
People were sort of already starting to simmer. And then you get these really crazy descriptions of food processing in the jungle in which they're poisoning rats, and then they just chop up the rat bodies and throw it into the meat, and meat is rotting and molding, and they scrape that off and throw a little formaldehyde or borax in it, and blood is dripping everywhere. There was just a firestorm of response.
Well, if you haven't made our listeners queasy up until now, I think you just
I can
did.
Do better. But when this book came out, of course, the Packers were like, this is fiction, this is fiction. And Doubleday Page had sent a copy of it to Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president. And he, of course, he was, this can't be right. So he sent an investigative team. Everyone is like, this can't be right. And they found that it was worse also. And there's these horrible descriptions in their report of cows falling into the workers' latrines and then just being dragged across the floor and, you know, chopped up after that and going off into whatever. Roosevelt, when he got this report, used it to blackmail Congress. The first Meat Inspection Act passed in June of 1906, and with it, Wiley's long-fought-for food and drug law was passed right after that. So the one led to the momentum that finally pushed the other over.
So this sort of seems like ancient history now. all of this happened 100 years ago or so. We have a whole regulatory system in place to monitor food safety. Most of our foods are labeled. How safe is our food now?
It's a lot safer than it was in the 19th century. There are labels, and the government does consider this part of its business. We've laid down a foundation in which consumer protection is part of the job of government, which was not true in the 19th century. So that's a huge deal. So our food is safer, not as safe as it should be for all the reasons. And this, to me, was what made this story so applicable today. It's not as safe as it should be for all the reasons that it was not as safe as it should be in 1906 when we start duking out these regulations. We compromise a lot with business. And so they don't test everything. There are actually materials that have been used in cosmetics that have moved over to food, but they've never been safety tested for food because they didn't kill anyone when they were used as cosmetic formulas, right?
Even though we're now eating them.
That's exactly right. One of the myths is that if it's on your label, it's been safety tested. It hasn't necessarily been.
Sounds like in some ways we are still living in Harvey Wiley's world.
I think we are. I think we're smarter and better at it, but we have not grown up as much as I think he would have hoped we would have done. I think he was the dissatisfied food regulator of the early 20th century. He would be dissatisfied today.
Deborah Blum directs the Night Science Journalism Program at MIT, and she's the author of the new book, The Poison Squad. Steve Paulson talked with her. And if you haven't guessed, we are talking about poison this hour, which can turn up in a lot of unexpected places. On your dinner plate, or in the garden.
So I was visiting a scientist who works on developing new varieties of lilies. He's a lily expert. As we were getting ready to leave, he said, "Hang on a minute, I want to show you something else I have growing in the corner over here. But don't tell anyone about this. I don't want my boss to know that I have one of these." The plant that he had was circulating among students on campus. And so students were telling him, "We're growing Erythroxylum coca, which is the plant that cocaine comes from." It was a South American shrub. It would be very hard to grow. The traditional Bolivian way to consume coca leaves is to chew on it. So this guy was immediately suspicious and said, "I don't think that's what you have. I don't see that growing in a dorm room. And I'm worried about what you kids are doing with that plant." But it took him a long time to get anyone to trust him enough to bring him a specimen of this plant. And sure enough, it was not Erythroxylum coca. And I don't remember the name of the plant, but it was quite deadly. It was quite toxic. And if you chewed on enough of those leaves, your throat would close up and you wouldn't be able to breathe and you'd have to go to the hospital. So that's what he had. And that's what got me thinking about how easily it is for people to be misled or fooled. Look, I go on a walk either through a garden or on a hike with someone and they'll pluck a berry off a bush and go, "Here, try this." And I'm always like, "You know what? I'm good."
So pick your poison carefully. We'll be right back. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about poison this hour, and I don't want to make you feel like you're walking through a minefield every day, but did you know that there are a lot of poisons growing all around us?
I got to thinking, you know, there are a lot of famous stories in history about poisonous plants. Socrates was killed by hemlock and on. And I thought it would be interesting to tell those stories, not to write a field guide to poisonous plants, but to talk about when plants have actually killed someone or been used in warfare or for some dark and nefarious purpose.
Amy Stewart is a mystery writer. She's the author of the best-selling Cop Sisters series. She is also a serious gardener with a side gig, writing about wicked plants. She introduced Shannon Henry Kleiber to a few of her favorites.
Abraham Lincoln's mother was killed by a plant. She was killed in a very indirect way. The plant is white snake root. It's poisonous. Cows would graze on this plant. The poison would make them sick, but also get into their milk, and people would drink the milk and get sick and die. And that was called milk sickness. And it was a real problem throughout the 1800s, in fact.
The mystery part of it is interesting.
It took us a long time to really understand how plant poisons work, in part because how do you even do those experiments? The KGB starts assassinating people with ricin, which is an extract of the castor bean seed, and we did not in medical science even know how much ricin it took to kill a person. So as late as the 1970s, we're doing experiments where we're figuring out what would be the lethal dose for a pig that weighs roughly the equivalent of a human. It's amazing how much we still don't know about toxins in plants.
I read that you have a poisonous plant garden and that it's been listed as one of the, I think, 18 most unusual gardens in the world.
Well,
tell me about that.
I wanted to grow these plants. It's weird to write a book about plants that you've never grown and maybe never even seen. And some of them are pretty hard to get. You can't just walk into a garden center and say, I would like 12 mandrakes. Mm-hmm. They're just not for sale. But as I'm doing these interviews and reaching out to people in the horticulture community, plants start getting offered to me.
Kind of secretly, like?
Actually, yes. Yeah. I really did go visit a farm that grew a lot of very poisonous and strange plants, including some illegal plants. It was up in the hills. And before I went up there, where I knew there was going to be no cell phone coverage, I remember calling my husband and going, if I don't call you back in an hour, something has happened up there.
What plants?
So like ayahuasca, maybe you've heard of. Yeah. A hallucinogenic plant from South America, things that maybe are not quite illegal, but that the DEA is very aware of and that are hallucinogenic plants. But they were growing straight up, you know, it was a pot farm and it was they were growing other illegal, straight up illegal plants as well.
So you started collecting.
Yeah, so I start collecting them, but they need to go somewhere. So I planted a poison garden and I really made it, I had fun making it creepy. So like rather than plant markers, I had these cement tombstones.
Wow.
That identified what the plant does to you, madness or blindness. I found a company that makes resin skeletons for medical schools, and they sell their factory seconds online.
Cool.
So I had all these slightly defective skulls and hands. And so I had
some sort, incredible.
Right,
yeah.
Like a skeleton buried. So it was creepy and wonderful, but not terribly practical.
Was it beautiful? I mean, opium poppies are beautiful, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these are very pretty plants. So I was growing foxglove digitalis, which is a heart medication. It's a great example of a plant that's both medicine and poison, depending on the dose and who's taking it. And tobacco's beautiful. It flowers, and it's depending on which one you grow, can be quite large and impressive-looking plant.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a lot of them are very pretty.
I've heard that some people think plants have a consciousness. I was reading something about maybe the nightshades have an ability to hate. Do you think that's true?
Well, I'm fascinated by this, and it is something that we're finding out more about. So one way that plants communicate is through root exudates. So they exude chemicals out of the roots into the soil, and those root exudates can attract certain microbes or other living creatures that might help the plant do better or ward off enemies. And there are also plants that do the same thing above ground, that if they're under attack, they can release a pheromone that would attract the predator of the bug that's attacking them. So in other words, they can signal for help. So this certainly suggests that they're able to react to stimuli around them in a way that we didn't know was possible and we're sort of just starting to figure out.
Do you think that there's a reason that we have these toxic plants in our world?
Oh, sure. They're just defending themselves. This is something I try to remind people of, is that you don't have to be terrified of poisonous plants. They're just trying to make a living, you know. They're trying to protect themselves against predators. It's a mistake to think that because something's green and comes out of the ground, that it's all natural and it's therefore good for us. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to think that anything that's plant-based is more healthy and superior in some way. But strychnine is 100% plant-based. Mm-hmm. But so is cyanide. So is ricin. They're just trying to keep from getting eaten. Plants are rooted in the ground. They don't have opposable thumbs. They can't run and hide. They can't fight back. But, you know, that's why plants have thorns or spines or stinging nettles. I mean, they're all just trying to keep predators away. So they inflict pain and suffering on anyone who tries to eat them.
That was Amy Stewart. She writes mystery novels in addition to books like Drunken Botanist and Wicked Plants. And that was Shannon Henry Kleiber talking with her. One of the really fascinating things about poisons is that in small doses, they can cure, but in larger doses, kill. So much power in a simple leaf or a mushroom or a white powder. So much potential. For the right or wrong person, it can be tempting. Catherine, if I wanted to poison someone today, what would be the best way to go about it?
First of all, I assume that you want to get away with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, in that case, what you need to do is a very good study of a person's health and if they have any particular diseases. You want to pick a poison that mimics some of the symptoms. What you're trying to do is avoid the autopsy. The other alternative, of course, is to poison someone using whatever you want and then flee the country to somewhere that doesn't have an extradition treaty. That's your only real option if you want to poison someone and get away with it.
And what about delivery mechanisms?
It's really person-specific. Contact poisons, poisons that have been inhaled, injected, swallowed, added to food.
It's a very intimate kind of killing, don't you think?
It's a statement. It is quite staggering and terrifying, the amount of thought that goes into these processes. It's very, very devious and unpleasant.
Catherine Harkup is a chemist with an expertise in poison. She lives in Valencia, Spain. I won't speculate as to why, but we reached her by Skype. She's also made a close study of a famous poisoner, someone who knocked off a good 300 victims, using everything from arsenic to cyanide. Her name? Agatha Christie, the mystery writer.
Oh, she was so good. You just mention Agatha Christie, and you can imagine a body on a library carpet with a half-spilt cup of tea next to them. And, you know, that's what Agatha Christie was about.
One of her favorites was arsenic. How come?
It was extraordinarily popular among British poisoners in the 19th century. It was used a frightening amount to bump off spouses and various rich relatives.
Wasn't it called the inheritance powder?
Yeah, the French gave it the glorious name of inheritance powder. It was embarrassingly easy to get hold of. Certainly before the 1850s in the UK, you could just walk into almost any shop and just ask outright for arsenic, and they'd just hand it over to you.
It's a pretty gruesome way to die, isn't it?
It's horrific. I think TV and films, they do a massive disservice, because if you watch TV poisonings, people take a forkful of food, they choke a bit, and they're dead on the floor in seconds. And that's not how it happens in the vast majority of cases. Poisoning takes, depending on the poison, but most cases, poisoning takes hours. And it is an agonizing few hours. It is very upsetting for all concerned.
Which brings me to actually one of the things that always makes me a little uneasy reading, especially Christie's novels. She usually uses poisons that people can get hold of, sometimes that they can just brew up themselves, say from plants growing in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
I always used to read them and think, I don't think you should be letting people know this. Has anybody ever actually copied her murders in the real world?
There are a few examples where that has happened. There was a case in France where a man, for reasons I don't know, he took a strong dislike to this particular woman who was a great friend of his uncle's. And so he had this particularly devious ploy to get rid of her. He added atropine to a bottle of wine and gave the wine to his uncle as a gift, knowing that his uncle very rarely, if ever, drank wine. So he thought his uncle would be safe, but special occasion, when the friend comes around, they'll open up the wine and the woman will die. Unfortunately, the uncle saved the wine for Christmas Day.
Oh no.
He and his wife drank it, and unfortunately, he died. Now, the uncle was quite old. People put it down to natural causes. But when they went round to the uncle's house to kind of clear up and prepare everything for the funeral, there was this bottle of wine on the table. And, you know, this is France. They're like, well, it's wine. So they toasted the uncle. And these people got sick as well. So this was the first alert that it was something sinister going on. So they went round to this guy's flat and they searched his flat for evidence. And they found an Agatha Christie book. And the book just happened to fall open at the page with the atropine poisoning in it, and he was convicted.
Oh, my gosh. That's the first case I know of murder through literary influence.
Well, as I always point out to anyone who is thinking of using Agatha Christie as inspiration, the murderer always gets found out. So it is not actually a very good guide.
The ones that scared me most were the ones that anybody could concoct with ordinary household ingredients. Wasn't there one poisoning with nicotine?
Mm-hmm.
And the murderer made it by soaking cigarettes in water? I had no idea you could do that.
Yeah, it's terrifying. People used to use nicotine. They used to make this kind of cigarette butt brew and use it as an insecticide on their roses. And there's one unfortunate case of a man who kept his nicotine brew in an old brandy bottle. You can see where this is going. So he goes to his garden shed to have a crafty slug of brandy before dinner. And of course, he picks up the wrong bottle. And he knew instantly that he'd drunk from the wrong bottle. And he ran back to his house. He opened up the fridge and he tried to drink milk to counteract the effects.
Did it work?
No, he was dead before he could raise the milk to his lips.
Wow. In some of those classic murder mysteries, I remember detectives referring to poison as a woman's weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And with some contempt. Like if you're a man, you're going to stand up straight and bludgeon somebody to death. But a woman will sneak arsenic into your dessert while smiling in your face.
It's complete rubbish. The numbers work something along the lines of, there are 10 times as many male murderers as there are female murderers. Yes, women use poison more often than men, but in terms of pure numbers, there are more male poisoners than female.
Hmm.
And women still use other methods more often than they use poison.
Hmm.
So unfortunately, it's a bit of a myth that poison is a woman's weapon. Agatha Christie, which you mentioned, she was rather egalitarian about the whole thing. I think she had a 50-50 split for her poisoning.
Equal opportunity poisoning. But see, I think that there's more in that stereotype. The fact that we associate poisoning with a kind of sneakiness,
mm-hmm.
and that we also feel
contempt for it in some way.
Yeah.
If you think on a larger societal scale, at least in the West, it seems like poisoning your political opponents is a no-go. That's considered unethical.
Mm.
But why?
There does seem to be an extra special category for poisoners above other forms of murder. And from a very basic point of view, to poison someone, you have to think about it. You have to acquire your poison. You have to administer it. And as I said, it takes a long time for people to die. That is a lot of opportunity and time for you to reflect on what you're doing and to change your mind. So I think this persistence and pursuance of that goal is an extra special kind of maliciousness that we associate with poisoning, as well as this kind of sneakiness. It's not fair play when you sneak something into someone's cup of tea. If you brandish a knife in front of them, they have at least the opportunity to see the weapon and defend themselves, etc., etc. So I think maybe it comes down to our sense of fair play as well.
Mm.
Throughout history, poisoners have been singled out for especially cruel punishments above and beyond your average murderer.
Huh.
So it's not a recent distaste for the poisoner. It's been around for a long time.
I remember reading that Alexander Litvinenko, the dissident Russian spy who was killed with radioactive tea, polonium-210, he told the New York Times like 2 years before he was assassinated that in the Russian Foreign Service, poison was seen as just another weapon, like a gun. What's the difference between bullets and poison?
You're absolutely right. There is no difference. The person will die regardless. So maybe our attitude that poisoning is somehow even more awful than taking another person's life. Maybe we're the ones that are in the wrong and we should see poisoning as just another weapon.
Does it seem like poisons are evolving or being developed? I've noticed that the new string of political assassinations, it's all with nerve agents or radioactive elements. Whatever happened to old-fashioned cyanide?
I don't know why cyanide isn't used so much these days. You actually need quite a bit of it compared to the sort of Novichok and polonium-210 alternatives. It's a frighteningly tiny amount of polonium that can kill someone if they eat it. Likewise, with the Novichok poisons, you only need the slightest drop on your skin, and that can be fatal. So in terms of quantity, it makes transporting these substances a lot easier.
I was assuming that the Russians are using poison to kill, and these dramatic poisons, to deliver a message. You can't escape us, no matter where you go.
Yeah.
We'll find you, and not only find you, we'll get physically really close to you. We'll be watching you. We'll know the patterns of your behavior.
Mm-hmm. You don't know where this poison might be concealed, or you know if it's just been left on a door handle, or if it's in a cup of tea, or whatever. It's this invasive, creeping kind of idea that it can invade your very intimate, personal space.
Catherine Harkup is a chemist and writer and author of A is for Arsenic. We tracked her down in Valencia, Spain, where she is currently investigating another classic literary poisoner, William Shakespeare. Coming up, one of the most famous poisoning stories in America is not quite over.
This is Peg.
1904 to 1929.
Yes.
And what was it you were telling me about underneath this stone, she's buried in a lead-lined coffin?
Yes, yes. When they exhumed her, they took her to Argonne National Lab, and when they brought her back, she is in a lead-lined coffin, although one of my aunts, she always thought that they never returned the body.
So there may be a lot of radioactive bodies here in this cemetery.
I'm sure there are.
It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. In the 1920s and 30s, radium, the glow-in-the-dark wonder element discovered by Marie Curie, spawned a whole new American industry: luminous clock and watch faces. Radium dial painting factories sprang up. They employed hundreds of girls and young women to do this really delicate painting. And the girls were told to keep their brushes sharp by gently sucking them, or lip pointing. Now, if you know anything about radioactivity, you can guess what happened next. Kate Moore spent years investigating this story, and the result is her book, Radium Girls.
I was transfixed by this extraordinary true story of women fighting for their rights. And I was really struck that as the girls are lip pointing, putting their paintbrushes between their lips, which was the technique they were taught, and you know they're swallowing radioactive substances, you're reading what they're doing and you're thinking, no, don't do it, in the same way that if you watch a horror movie, you just think, you know, the young blonde heroine as she wanders down that darkened alley and you're thinking, don't do it. You feel the same about these girls.
You described some wonderful scenes. So radium, it's glow in the dark, as we said. It made the girls literally glow and shine, and they loved that.
They did, absolutely. They themselves would actually use some of that paint as makeup. They put it on their eyelids for eyeshadow. They paint their teeth with it. There was a report.
Why would you want glow-in-the-dark teeth?
I know. It's a slightly strange. Catherine Wolfe, one of the Illinois dial painters, talks of how the women would wear their good dresses to the plant because after they finished work, they'd go out in the dance halls and the radium girls would be the ones shining and shimmering with this ethereal glow as they're twirling and dancing to the latest jazz tunes.
God, that's just so poignant, really.
Yeah. You know, for them, it was just a joke and a laugh. And so they were this glamorous kind of entourage that would glow as they walked home through the streets of Newark and Orange in New Jersey and in Ottawa in Illinois.
Who was the first girl to die of radium poisoning, and what happened to her?
Her name was Molly Maggia. So it started in Molly in her teeth, which was true of many dial painters. She had a bad tooth that was hurting her, so she went to the dentist and he extracted it. But then her next tooth started to hurt, and then the next one. She goes to the dentist, absolutely desperate for some kind of help, for some kind of ease to this excruciating pain that she's suffering. And the dentist reaches into her mouth with his hand and gently probes at her jawbone, and it breaks against his fingers, and he is able to lift it out of her mouth, and a week later he does the same to the rest of the bone in her mouth. And just to explain what radium does, so it's a bone seeker, and that could be your arm bone, a leg, your hip, your spine, your jawbone, and it was actually making holes in the woman's bones. So when the doctors studied them, they found that they were honeycombed and moth-eaten. And so what Molly Maggio was trying to treat with aspirin was her, you know, her bones were literally having holes drilled in them. Catherine Sharp, one of the radium girls, said that the pain could only be compared to a dentist drilling on a live nerve, days, weeks, months at a time. That's what she said the pain of being a radium girl was like.
And in the meantime, the girls would go to the companies, and the companies would say no, or they'd say you're imagining it or you're making it up. And they paid doctors to testify against the girls. The level of the cover-up is kind of hard to believe.
It's really quite shocking. As you say, the depth of depravity to which they would sink. They hired private detectives to dig up dirt on these women. You know, they actively lied to them. They concealed medical test results. And it's just astonishing. You actually can't believe that anyone would be that inhumane.
There's one, I remember, I think you wrote that at one point they tested a lot of the girls for their radium levels. They didn't give the girls the test results, but they themselves created a list of who was going to die first.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. They graded them depending on how radioactive they were. And so I saw in the archives when I was researching, it's there in black and white, a list of all the women's names and a number next to that name, you know, from 1 through to 5.
I don't see how somebody could look at a woman, a young woman, and know you've got her name on a list and you know she's going to be dead in a year, and look her in the face and say, you're fine.
Well, I think it just goes to show just how expendable and disposable people thought of women at that time. There was one firm in Connecticut who settled with their girls. And there's one woman, Mildred Cardo, who died only 6 months after she'd been married. And the firm offered her husband a settlement. But the sum they offered him was $43.75.
Oh, my God.
Less than $50 for a human life.
Can you pick one of your favorite young women to tell us about? Just introduce us and, yeah, tell us about her.
Okay, well, it's very hard to pick just one, of course. But I will pick Catherine Wolfe Donahue, who was one of the Illinois dial painters. Catherine was 19 when she started work there, and it was her first job. And she worked there for 9 years. She was actually fired for being sick. She had a limp, basically, because the radium had settled in her leg. And they said her limping was causing talk. You've given 9 years of your life to a company and they fire you for being sick, but they've caused the sickness. That was a very big mistake, because what Catherine Donahue did was that she fought back. And it takes years. So by the time that Illinois women are filing suit, it's the Great Depression. And so the town turn against her. And the women are disbelieved, they're shunned, they're told they're liars and frauds and cheats. And by the time the case comes to court, Catherine is incredibly sick. She has a sarcoma, a bone tumour on her hip caused by the radium, and it's the size of a grapefruit. The doctors talk about her white blood cell count, which should be around 8,000, and she's only got a few hundred. Her teeth are falling out, her jawbone is crumbling in her mouth. She is close to death. And yet Catherine gives evidence on her deathbed. She's too ill to actually physically go to court. So the court comes to her, and in her sitting room on East Superior Street in Ottawa, Catherine lies on her couch with a blanket over her, and she gives evidence in a weak, faltering voice. She can barely open her eyes even as she's giving her testimony. And it's too late for her. Radium poisoning is fatal. She knows she is going to die, but she does it for her friends, and she does it for her family, for her children, for her husband. And I just think that is just a shining example of what these women did. You know, as you say, their bodies were crumbling, they were impoverished, they were facing certain death, they were grieving from the friends they'd lost, and yet they stood up, they fought for their rights.
Wow. They did win in the end. The Supreme Court did finally rule against the company. What happened next? What happened to the company and to the remaining girls?
Unfortunately, yes, they did win. It was ultimately largely a moral victory. There was basically only a pot of money of $10,000 for the women to split between them. But this case, the Radium Girls case, was a landmark case. It was one of the first cases in which an employer was found responsible for the health of its employees. And along the way of the Radium Girls fight, they were changing laws. Hundreds, thousands, millions of other workers were protected. And so I hope what the Radium Girls book does is to give these women a voice. And that showcases that it isn't just a heartbreaking story. It is actually a story of courage and of strength.
Kate Moore. Her book is called The Radium Girls, The Dark Story of America's Shining Women. So I don't know why, but this story really stayed with me. I just couldn't stop thinking about those girls, maybe out of some kind of identification or empathy. I think every woman has had the experience at some point of feeling like their personal reality is being dismissed by some kind of authority figure. Somehow I just felt like this story was not done. And that turns out to be true, which is how I wound up standing in a graveyard in Ottawa, Illinois, with the descendants of two of the Radium Girls.
My name is Darlene Holm, and my aunt was Margaret Looney. My mother and her sisters called her Peg.
My name is Kathleen Kofoid, and my great aunt was Catherine Donahue.
It's a perfect summer day. The cemetery is a little ways out of town, on top of a hill. There's a guy on a riding mower keeping things neat, and some simple, unremarkable gravestones.
Lot, this is my grandfather, grandmother, this is Peg.
1904 to 1929.
Yes, spent a lot of time here as a child. We would come, we would bring flowers, and remember coming here with my mother and my aunts. My sister and I would run around.
And what was it you were telling me about underneath this stone? She's buried in a lead-lined coffin.
Yes, yes. When they exhumed her, they took her to Argonne National Lab, and when they brought her back, she is in a lead-lined coffin, although one of my aunts, she always thought that they never returned the body.
So there may be a lot of radioactive bodies here in this cemetery.
I'm sure there are. There was a gentleman, his name was Ken. He used to have a Geiger counter, and he would walk around the cemetery, and he could tell where each of the dial painters were buried because the Geiger counter would go off. And it's so peaceful here, and it's so pretty, and no one would think.
Ottawa, Illinois is a pretty town of about 18,000. It's got a leafy main square, site of the first Lincoln-Douglas debate. Most of the radium dial painters lived their whole lives within these few square blocks. They went to school and church here. The radium dial factory shut down in 1936, but the building itself, contaminated and radioactive, stood here for decades.
Well, see, I lived down the alley from the radium dial. And down in the basement where they had stored the radium, they actually put a meat locker down there. Many people bought meat from the meat locker. And I can go around the neighborhood to families that lived in each and every house. And at least one of my friend's parents, if not both of them, died of cancer. They did tear down the original radium dial in 1969. I was in high school, and I would come home from school, and the dust from the building would have seeped into my parents' home. It would be on the windowsills. We would have to vacuum. We would have to wipe everything down. Then after that, when both of my parents die of cancer and I see other people in the neighborhood and they are dying of cancer, it really makes me wonder. How could it not?
And guess what they did with the radioactive rubble?
They used it as fill. They dumped it all over town.
Wait, they just took all the remains of the building, which would have had a lot of radium?
Yes.
There's probably elements of that building not only buried all over town, but people might still have souvenirs.
Here's another thing I find unbelievable. While the radium girls were dying, the factory owner closed up shop, moved three blocks away, and opened up again, but under a different name, Luminous Processes. They used a slightly different painting technique, but the radium was everywhere, on workers' clothes, shoes, fingers. They got cancer at twice the national rate. And yet, the factory stayed open until 1978. When the EPA moved in, there were radioactive hotspots all over town. Ottawa, Illinois became a Superfund site.
You know, when I was a kid, we lived up on the north side and where some of the areas that they dumped the waste. When your neighborhood friends' houses are getting dug around with guys in spacesuits, basically, is what you thought when you were a kid. You know, they're digging up the whole neighborhood, but they're saying, oh, it's fine. You can just still live there in the house while your whole yard and everything is going away. And so a lot of kids through the years, because of playing and all that, they all had ill effects from it, too.
How many people in town do you think know this whole history?
A lot of people don't.
Yes.
There are a lot of local people, a lot of people that I've talked to in Ottawa, and I got a lot of comments from people. They did not know the story. They had lived here their entire lives.
No, people don't talk about it.
There are a few signs that that may be changing, though. A new brewery opened up recently, founded by four local guys who named it Radium City Brewing in honor of the dial painters. And there's a new statue in town with a fountain.
It represents a radium girl. There was a girl from Mendota that had done a history project on the radium dial girls. She actually spearheaded that we needed a monument. And so the city worked with her. The city worked with her, and they decided to put the monument here, kind of an out-of-the-way spot.
But yeah, I bring my kids down here and whomever else visits, because it's important that they know. It's not just our family history. They should know what happened to women, you know?
Do you feel betrayed?
That's kind of funny. I don't know if I feel betrayed. I think they betrayed the whole community. I think they betrayed the trust of women. I think they betrayed the future of our community, because it's still here and it's still a problem. That's why I find it frustrating that the city is allowing people to build, because it's the same foundation. There's a new business going in right next door. They want to build a family business that's going to serve ice cream to the community. There's no way that I would allow anybody I know to go there and purchase anything.
Darlene Halm and Kathleen Kofoid, they're descendants of two of the original Radium Girls, Peg Looney and Catherine Donahue, and they are still buried there in lead-lined coffins. That's it for this hour. There's always more in our podcast feed, plus extra articles on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Shannon Henry Kleiber produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.